Okay, let me start. First thing is I wanted to remind everybody that for the class on Friday, that's going to be a lecture devoted solely to an analysis of the Taylor book, the A.J.P. Taylor book, The Origins of the Second World War, which you all bought. So be sure to bring in your copy of the book, because I'm going to be talking about all these different things in the text, and it would help if you could follow along when I give the page numbers and so on. Does anyone have any questions about anything related to the course? Yes? That's right, that's deliberate. I used to do review sessions. I'll tell you why I don't do it. Because a review session kind of gives people the idea that the essence of the course is going to be distilled off for them and provided to them on a silver platter. So it's like what I want in this course is for you guys to learn how to do the thinking yourself. So I felt like a review session kind of runs counter to that pedagogically. So what I urge you guys to do is to meet in like little study groups and try and figure out on the basis of what's in the syllabus and what I said in the first lecture about what the questions are going to be, and then just answer them. I think that's a much more effective way of preparing for the exam than a review session. If people really disagree with that, let me know. But yeah, right. Yeah, that book is, you should just basically know that it happened and that approximately when it happened. But that book, that Sontag book, it's essentially background. You know, it's like not everyone has a real familiarity with the basic history of that period. And he gives it to you in such an easy to digest way. I mean, that's a book that you could appreciate at all kinds of different levels. You know, the high school student can appreciate it at one level. Someone who's been teaching the stuff for 50 years could still get a lot of it out of it on a totally different level. So it's just background. This is a class in international politics. So it's about relations between states, not what goes on within particular countries. I mean, obviously, that's part of the story. You should know some of the basics, like, you know, that Germany had a Nazi government from 1933 on. But the domestic side, revolutions and so on, that's not what you're going to be tested on tomorrow. Yeah. How many? What are you supposed to? Names? What are you supposed to know? The really important people you should know, not just to recognize their names, but you should kind of know the basic lines of policy that they were associated with. So it's like someone asked you, what's the difference between Woodrow Wilson and Adolf Hitler? You should know. Well, you should be able to say one or two things about that. Stresemann, you should know. Clemenceau, you should know. People that I talked about at some length. However, you know, these minor people that get mentioned in passing, like that Ruhr magnate that I referred to, the guy's name is Kröpner, I don't expect you to know that. The Seydoux plan, I don't expect you to be able to know that. It's the big stuff. You want to keep your eyes focused on the big picture. So that should be the measure. I saw some other hands. No? Yeah? I said the Sontag book was the background that survey. The other readings you're going to be tested on, but it's not going to be that you'll be asked to analyze those other readings. Even the Taylor thing that I'm talking about on Friday, I'm not going to ask you to analyze that. But I will ask, or at least for some of them, for you to tell me what the basic argument is, the core of the argument, right? Again, it's this pedagogical thing. I want people to develop that skill of focusing on what this author is trying to convince us of, and because that's the first step in analysis. So don't think I'm saying, oh no, all that stuff is just background. You don't have to pay any attention to it other than its background. That's not true. The canon thing is important. The Wilson speeches, my thing about the July crisis, the Taylor book, and I think the Utley book as well, because we'll have time to cover the Pacific War before the next week. There's another hand. I saw another hand. No? Okay. All right. So where are we so far? What was I trying to do the last couple lectures? One of the main points was people think that there's a very sharp difference between the 1920s and the 1930s, between Germany, the democracy in the 1920s, Nazi dictatorship in the 1930s. They think that, there were certain disturbances in the immediate post-Versailles period, but things settled down, and by the late 1920s, things had recovered their balance, and it was basically a peaceful order that was coming into that Locarno period. One of the basic points is not so fast. The dividing line between the 1920s and the 1930s was not nearly as sharp as people think. There were, German policy in the 1920s was not accommodationist. It was not run by people who we would view as, quote, good Europeans, who are interested in burying the hatchet with Germany's Western neighbors. It was run by people who still thought in power political terms. German nationalists wanted to build up German power, change the status quo, throw off the Versailles constraints as a means to that end. Right. And what that suggests is that the fundamental political problem that lay at the heart of the international political system, great power political system, had not been resolved by Locarno and by the kind of atmospherics associated with the late 1920s. That problem remained intact. It's a very nice line from a French journalist written around 1930, when these problems between France and Germany were just flaring up again. 1930, before Hitler came to power, don't forget. This guy says, when friends quarrel, people say it's because of a misunderstanding. In reality, it's because a misunderstanding is being cleared up. And that's what happened. It's like this whole notion of Locarno would be a beginning. Well, the Germans thought a beginning toward the removal of these constraints on German power. The beginning of Germany's resurgence as the number one power in Europe. For Britain and France, it was a beginning toward a new world in which power considerations were not terribly important, in which Germany would become friends with Britain and France and basically accept the new status quo as on an equal basis. Though the fundamental political problem, whose power would dominate Europe, that problem remained intact. Because once you get rid of the constraints on German power, Germany's resources are such that Germany would once again emerge as the number one power in Europe. And again, stronger relative to the other powers of Europe than she had been even in 1914. Okay, that's kind of an important point. On the other hand, one does not want to take that sort of argument too far. Right? All these elements of continuity from the 1920s to the 1930s, yes, they do go to show that there's an underlying structural problem. Continuity always suggests structure is of fundamental importance. Change suggests statecraft is a fundamental force. The more continuity you have, the easier it is to impute structural causes to what you see going on. But you don't want to take that too far, because there were dramatic changes, looking back especially, that were introduced by the coming to power of the Nazis in Germany in January 1933. It was different from Stresemann. He was different in two ways, both in terms of his ultimate goals, which were much more far-reaching than Stresemann's had ever been. The whole kind of carving out of an empire in the East, the transformation of Germany into a great world empire. Stresemann never intended anything like that. And Hitler differed in a second way as well, which had to do with style, pace, willingness to take risks, the intensity with which you can pursue these goals. I should say there's a very nice book that came out a few years ago by a British historian named Adam Tooze called Wages of Destruction. And Tooze looks at these events of the 1930s through the eyes of an economic historian. And his basic argument about Germany is that Germany is trying to play in the big leagues, but she doesn't quite have the resources to do so. Germany is a poor country. And even with Nazi control of the German economy and the Nazi interest in squeezing out every last ounce of power from the German economy, there were objective limits to how far the Germans could go. It was very hard for them to kind of punch above their weight. And they're constantly confronted with these objective constraints, economic constraints, on the amount of power that they can generate. But that sense of a Germany as a kind of a weak country that had a certain window of opportunity that it could exploit, that implied that if Germany was going to radically transform her position in the world, she was going to have to act fast. She couldn't just sit on her hands and wait for the fundamental objective factors in history to do their work. This Germany had to exploit the fact that other countries were paralyzed, that the possible opponents of Germany were divided, that the British were distracted for other reasons, that the Western powers were preoccupied with internal problems relating to the Great Depression. This meant that Germany could move and change the status quo before her chances of doing so slipped irretrievably away. Okay. So there are differences. The Nazis are proposed to move much faster and to go much further than the Sisters. But this didn't mean that they opted for a policy of full speed ahead, rising up against the Versailles system in a very direct way. They had a strategy. Strategy was to take things one step at a time. The key thing was to build up Germany's military power. And to that end, all sorts of resources were poured into the building up of Germany's own forces. Once Germany's own forces were built up, then you could move ahead in various ways. You could build fortifications in the west so that you wouldn't have to worry so much about defending yourself against a possible attack from the Western power. And if you were secure in the west, you could take your forces, deploy them in the east, and use them ultimately to change the status quo, territorial status quo in the east. Annexing Austria, taking over all these areas inhabited by Germans in Eastern Europe, getting back the areas that had been lost to Poland after World War I, and then eventually going much, much further than that. Okay. But as you're moving in that direction, especially since Hitler had been open about what his long-term ambitions were, the book Mein Kampf is not just published in German, it was translated into foreign languages, including English, and read outside of Germany. Given all this, given the fact that one could reasonably infer that other countries would feel threatened and would want to deal with this problem sooner rather than later, to nip it in the bud before it got totally out of hand. That meant that Germany was going to have to go through a danger zone. And the last thing she wanted to do was to behave in a way that would provoke an attack before Germany was strong enough to deal with it. And so to minimize the risk, as Germany moved toward that danger zone, building up her power at home first, Hitler did all sorts of things. We talked about this last time. Well, a policy of caution. He gave these speeches talking about his hatred for war. He insisted that all he was asking for was for the Western powers to live up to their principles, to give Germany the same rights, including the right to self-determination, that every other nation had. You know, he kept in power the old German elite that had, run things under Weimar, certainly under the imperial regime before World War I. These are people that had a certain legitimacy in the West, that the West was used to dealing with. A token of the new regime's respectability, kept on people like that, deals with, one-on-one deals with the Poles to kind of, reduce the risk of countries ganging up against Germany, the Concordat with the Vatican, again, to give the new regime a certain international respectability. Well, deals with the British, the Anglo-German naval agreement, avoiding any challenge to British naval hegemony. Big mistake, according to Hitler, that the Kaiser's regime had made before 1914, taking on all of Germany's enemies at the same time. You have to isolate them, deal with them one by one. That's the basis of German policy during the first few years of the Nazi regime. But in 1936, there's this change. The key development here was the remilitarization of the Rhineland in March of 1936. All sorts of changes followed from that. Germany could fortify the Rhineland. A French attack against Germany would be hopeless. It was hard enough for the French to do anything anyway, because France had put her limited resources, France is still suffering severely from the Depression. What France could spend on the military was being spent on defenses, on the Maginot Line. And France didn't have anything to spare to develop an offensive military capability, an armored force capable of moving into Germany. So Germany is relatively secure in the West, increasingly so as the fortifications were built on Germany's western border. And as Germany became stronger and more able to build up her power, she could talk in a louder voice in terms of the changes she wants to make on her eastern border with regard to Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, first of all. But it's more than that. As people saw Germany's star rising, as people saw that Germany was becoming stronger, that also had certain consequences. See, smaller countries had a certain interest in, improving their relations with Germany, so as to minimize any possible German threat. And so you have Belgium moving away from her alliance with France and reestablishing her position as a neutral in European politics, thus weakening the position of the West still further. Italy also moving away from the alignment with the West, symbolized by the agreements at Stresa in 1935. Now Italy also moves toward the German camp, toward, you know, siding with Germany, siding with the, you know, the rising power, the power that's going to dominate. But the effects are like more far-reaching. As people see that this German problem has not been resolved, and that Germany is discontented, and that Germany is contemplating major changes in the European balance of power, changes that would be to the detriment of the Western powers, because the stronger Germany became, the more they would have to be worried about their own security. That simply encouraged other powers to challenge the interests of in the Far East, the Mediterranean. In the Far East, you have Japan looking at what's going on in Europe and increasingly coming to think, this is a golden opportunity for us. You know? The Western powers, they can't care nearly as much about their position in the Far East as they do about what's going on in Europe. The German problem is their main problem. This gives us a certain freedom of maneuver. And you see this even before the Nazi period, when the Japanese moved into northeast China, Manchuria, in 1931, and created a Japanese puppet state there called Manchukuo the following year. Also, to a certain extent, you see the same phenomenon at play with Italy. Italy knows that Britain and France are focused on Germany. This gives the Italians more freedom to move ahead in the Mediterranean, especially to try and create an Italian empire in East Africa. Italians move into Ethiopia in 1935. How is the West to deal with this? Is this a problem for the West? You know, it's not just Germany. It's Germany in Europe, Japan in East Asia, Italy in the Mediterranean and East Africa. Can you take on everybody at once? Are you strong enough to do that? If you're not strong enough to do that, then you have to make choices. But if you make choices, that means accommodating one of these challenges or two of these challenges in order to focus on the third. But if you pursue a policy of accommodation vis-a-vis Japan and East Asia, or vis-a-vis Italy and Ethiopia, then do you really have any moral standing for opposing Germany and Europe? If you oppose Italy in Ethiopia there, with the argument that collective security is you either have it or you don't. You can't have it in a selective way. If you believe in collective security, you have to support Italy and sanctions against Italy and Ethiopia. Then that provokes the Italians. And if you don't want to provoke the Italians too much, then doesn't that sacrifice your claim to be standing up for the League of Nations and for principles of collective security? I mean, the Western powers are in a bit of a bind here. How do they propose to deal with it? There's a policy that gets adopted. It's called the policy of appeasement. Well, the term appeasement was used first in the 1920s. It had a very positive connotation. Appeasement, you know, pacifying things, settling things, you know, calming things down. That's what we want. It's only after World War II, actually in 1939, that the term appeasement came to have a very negative connotation. And people, you know, I should say, after the war, Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of Britain during the war, the great hero of Britain during the war, he was thrown out of office by his own electorate at the end of the war, and went back and wrote these books, this history of the Second World War, including a first volume called The Gathering Storm, came out in 1948, and dealt with the run-up to the war, with the whole story of the interwar period, especially the 1900s. It's this basic notion that you look at the policy of Britain and France, it's morally weak. These people are morally weak. They pursue a policy that we now know is a disaster, that we now know is hotly, really regrettable, this policy of appeasement, big mistake. And that for many years was the standard view, and it's still to a certain extent the standard view in the culture as a whole. But historians have changed. When the British opened up their diplomatic documents and people could kind of go in and see what policymakers were thinking at the time, the whole issue was came across as by no means that clear cut. And in fact, people started to think of, how can you criticize them for being appeasers? They essentially had no choice. The problem was essentially unmanageable through any other way. This, for example, is from an article by the historian Paul Schrader called Munich and the British Tradition, came out in 1976. If one begins to tot up all the plausible motivations for appeasement, fear and horror of another war, Britain's state of military unpreparedness, fear for the British economy and the empire, the unprepared state of public opinion, the isolationism of the dominions in the United States, lack of confidence in France, lack of interest in Central Europe, failure to understand Hitler and Nazism, fear and distrust of the Soviet Union and communism, the absence of a viable alternative presented either by the conservative opposition or labor, and more, one sees that these are far more than enough to explain it. It was massively overdetermined. Any other policy in 1938 would have been an astounding, almost inexplicable divergence from the norm. Policy of appeasement makes sense. What choice do they have? What does the policy of appeasement mean? I mean, you know, giving Hitler a blank check, going along with whatever he wanted? Not quite. And here, I think if you're interested in reading further about this stuff, I think the most interesting book on that subject is by R.A.C. Parker. It's called Chamberlain and Appeasement, British Policy in the Coming of the Second World War. It's like, British ideas, yes, there's going to have to be changes in the status quo. But the key thing is that they should come about peacefully. We can't have a world based on force and on threats of force. We have to kind of make sure that everything is contained within a single structure, a structure that people could live with. Because if Germany is truly intent on, you know, becoming the hegemonic power in Europe, dominating all of Europe, so that Britain and France will just be pygmies forced to live in the shadow of this German superpower. Well, that you can't accept. But Germany has legitimate grievances. If we want peace, we should accommodate those legitimate grievances, but there are lines beyond which the Germans should not be allowed to move, and there are methods which the Germans should not be allowed to use, the method of threats and... That's a Chamberlain policy. This is what Parker says about it. He says, Chamberlain appeasement, it's true, was not a feeble policy of surrender and unlimited retreat. Chamberlain's the prime minister at this time. Chamberlain thought war futile and rejected it, but never pursued peace at any price. His policy meant intervention in continental Europe to induce Hitler's Germany to insist only on expansion so limited that it would not threaten the safety or independence of the United Kingdom. In retrospect, this appears a bold, venturesome policy, certain given the ambitions of Hitler to lead to an Anglo-German war. Well, that's a different view. And in fact, when you look at the story, there's a lot of evidence to support that view. What was Hitler's attitude toward Britain? He didn't want war with Britain. He wanted a free hand in the East. He wanted Britain to acquiesce in allowing Germany to do whatever she wanted in the East. In exchange for that, he was prepared, he said, to guarantee the British Empire. When he sent one of his top collaborators off to Britain as the ambassador, as the Ribbentrop thing was, and later became foreign minister. He said to him, "Ribbentrop, bring me back the British alliance." But given what British policy was, Hitler wasn't able to get what he wanted from the British. He resented the fact that the British did not want to give him a free hand, that they wanted to kind of draw limits to what Germany could do. So Britain was acting like she was Germany's governess, Germany's nanny. Intolerable. Intolerable also that Britain should pursue this policy now that Germany was strong and was interested in expanding toward the east, that's to say in areas that were beyond the reach of British power. Irrational. So he's coming to think that a showdown with Britain is inevitable in the long run. And in the documents, he refers frequently to the date of 1943 to 45. That's when Germany's going to have to face the Western. British policy, irrational. Since Germany's not threatening Britain directly, what are the British opposed to? He calls them hate-inspired adversaries at a famous meeting in November 1937 that was recorded by his adjutant, Colonel Holzbach. This is called the Holzbach Memorandum, a very famous document. They're hate-inspired adversaries. War with them is inevitable. But this does not mean he begins planning for pretty much an immediate showdown. So war is something he contemplates for the relatively distant future. Still, 6 to 8 years off. And in the meantime, though, Germany has to clear the decks in the East. Germany has to build up on power. Germany has to take advantage of the current situation where the West had not seriously rearmed, or as Germany's, armament efforts are really paying off now. Take advantage of that situation to bring about these changes which would improve Germany's position in this showdown with Britain and the continental world. Okay? And so what's the first thing in this letter? After March 1936, 1937, 1938, the pace of German policy quickens. Germans become more impatient. They begin putting more pressure, in particular on Austria. If Germany is secure in the West, what can anyone do if Germany moves against Austria? Even the Italians, by themselves, they can't do very much, and Italy is now moving closer to the German side. But the Germans don't want to simply invade Austria and conquer it. They want a more gradual solution where Nazi sympathizers are increasingly taken into the Austrian government, increasingly take over the Austrian government, and then that Nazi-dominated Austrian government would negotiate a voluntary union of Austria with Germany. The Anschluss, accession of Austria to Germany, this is the goal, but the hope is that it could be achieved in a less violent way. But the Austrian reaction, and Austria is run by conservative types, Catholic types, who dislike the idea of Austria being submerged and being absorbed into this huge German mass. They resist these attempts on the part of Hitler to promote that sort of evolutionary solution. And the Austrian Chancellor, named Schuschnigg, calls for a plebiscite in which the Austrians would vote whether they wanted Austria to be independent. And Hitler views this as a direct challenge. Schuschnigg is summoned to Germany. He has terms dictating to him. He's told that if he doesn't accede to these terms, Austria is going to be invaded. And in fact, a German invasion force is improvised the tanks break down on the roads from Germany into Austria. Austrians give way. Austria is absorbed into Germany in March of 1938, or the Austrian population is ecstatic about Western reaction. What can we do? Nothing. Austrian resources then are added to what Germany already has. And note the effect of the annexation of Austria on the position of Czechoslovakia. The Czechs are now surrounded, the Czech heartland, Bohemia, is surrounded by German power. And it's not surprising that practically as soon as the Austrian business is over, the Czech crisis starts. Now, Czechoslovakia has a lot of ethnic Germans living there, and they live mostly in the mountainous area on the fringes of Czechoslovakia. This is called the Sudetenland. These are called the Sudeten Germans, and they live in the Sudeten Mountains in that area. And these people had been encouraged by the rise of German power and by the fact that Germany is a prosperous country, whereas their areas are still suffering from the Depression, to agitate for union into Germany, or at least for local autonomy within Czechoslovakia. And the leader of the Sudeten Germans, his name is Henlein, is told that in negotiations with the Czech government that he's to pitch his demands always so high that the Czechs would never satisfy him. Right? The Germans want a crisis with Czechoslovakia, not a peaceful solution. And the Western powers see this coming, and now this is the big test. Test for Chamberlain. He doesn't want a war. How can you avoid a war? Well, maybe the Germans are serious about self-determination. Maybe these Germans living in Czechoslovakia should have the right to become part of the German Reich. As long as it's not done by ultimatum, as long as the process has some semblance of legitimacy and legality. So Chamberlain, in his own initiative, flies off to Germany and sees Hitler in his mountain retreat in Bavaria. It's called Birchs. And he thinks that he and Hitler are able to reach an agreement. All the areas that are inhabited by 50% Germans would go to Germany. There would be plebiscites and so on. And the Czechs are pretty much forced to go along with this. The French go along with it. Even though everyone knows that this is tantamount to essentially sacrificing a democracy in Europe, a democracy with which France had a treaty of alliance. Because once the Czechs lose those mountainous areas on their borders, Bohemian heartland, the area of Prague, is going to be indefensible. And it's panning out the remnant of Czechoslovakia being taken over by the Germans directly or becoming some German satellite that's ruled indirectly by China. Czech independence, it's clear, is being sacrificed. But Chamberlain gets his cabinet to go along with it. He goes back to Germany, and he meets with Hitler again, this time in the Rhineland in Godesberg. This is on the Berchtesgaden meeting was in the middle of September. Now he meets with Chamberlain Hitler meet at Godesberg in October 1st. And to Chamberlain's great disappointment, Hitler has upped the ante. Now Hitler presents a map and says, this is what it has to be. You know, kind of like an ultimatum. Now what's interesting here is, as far as Chamberlain was concerned, he was willing to accept it. But his colleagues in Britain, and his colleagues in the British cabinet, Hitler was going too far. They were not going to accede to, a German ultimatum like that. There was a limit to how far they were willing to go, and Hitler had exceeded that limit with the Gottesberg demands. Now, the interesting thing is, it's Hitler who backs off. Hitler backs down from Gottesberg. And people in the German elite, in the German army, are like kind of amazed. Say, unbelievable that Hitler is pulled back. I never want a war. And so when conference is proposed, the Munich conference, Germans accepted, in fact, had a hand in getting the Italians to actually propose this idea. The deals worked out somewhat less extreme than Gottesberg. The Germans still get basically what they wanted, but not quite in the way that, you know, we all think of Munich as this huge defeat for the West, the kind of collapse of the Western position. But it's very important to note that at the time, Hitler thought that he was the one who had been defeated. He viewed Munich as a defeat. You know, it's like deeply resented the fact that he was cheated out of a war, not a big war with the West, which he didn't want at that point, cheated out of a little war with the Czechs, which he very much did want. And Chamberlain, for his part, took much the same view. What he said was, Hitler has missed the bus. It's too late now. If war had broken out over the Czech crisis, Germany would have been in a strong position. But now, after Munich, the West has bought some breathing space. Time to rearm. And in fact, what happens after Munich is that the West really jacks up its rearming now. Chamberlain had hoped that after Munich was settled, Hitler had said it was his last territorial demand in Europe and so on, things would settle down and everything would be okay. There was no detente in Anglo-German relations, and in fact the tenor of relations between Germany and Western powers continued to deteriorate into early 1939. Could the British keep up the pace of rearmament at this vastly increased effort? A lot of people thought no. But the argument that the proponents of rearmament, like Lord Halifax, who was foreign secretary, he had been an appeaser, and now he's kind of moving in the other direction. Lord Halifax's argument was, and this is January of 1939, he says, this whole notion that Britain can't keep up the pace indefinitely, we don't have to worry about that. Because by the end of the year, either there's going to be a war, in which case we'll be glad that we rearmed at this level, and the wartime constraints would, wartime would mean that the constraints would come off, and we would devote ourselves very seriously to military spending. Or the Hitler regime would fall. That's the Halifax view. So you can see there's a kind of toughness now to the British position. Chamberlain is a bit of a laggard here, but in order to keep his position as prime minister, he has to trim his sails a bit, go along with the prevailing winds. Now, as far as the public is concerned, the key event takes place in March 1939, the German seizure of Prague. The Germans basically summon the new leaders of Czechoslovakia to Germany, and again they basically tell them, you have to put your country in our hands, take in our troops and make yourself into a German protectorate, which they do. The British had guaranteed at Munich the continuing political independence of Czechoslovakia. That guarantee, like the earlier Locarno guarantee of the demilitarized status of the Rhineland, end up not meaning very much, right? But as far as the public is concerned, this is a dramatic move, because you can understand perhaps why the Germans would want to get control of territories inhabited by ethnic Germans, like the Sudetenland and Austria. But now they were taking over areas inhabited by Slavs, by the Czechs. And that raised the question of, If they're willing to go beyond the limits in this particular case, maybe there's no limit at all. Maybe they're just not going to stop at all. until they have absolute dominance over all of Europe, in which case it's a question of survival for us. So the seizure of Prague in March 1939 results in this dramatic change in public thinking. Appeasement is discredited, policy resistance, that's the way you have to go. Hitler's view is, what's really important are the objective military realities. Now that Germany has taken control of Czechoslovakia, it's now Poland that's being surrounded by German power. Poland is weaker, not just that, but part of this new territory that Germany controls could be dangled in front of Poland as bait, you know, to get the Poles to, you know, accommodate Germany, to side with Germany. You know, to be a junior partner of Germany in a projected war of aggression in the East. But the Poles understand that if they went that route, that would be the end of their political independence. They don't do it. And to kind of, and it's a mark of how frightened the British are about how the situation was deteriorating, that they give guarantees, unilateral guarantees, of political independence to all these countries in East Central Europe, including Poland. But Hitler starts making these demands on the Poles. Poles don't give in. To Hitler's surprise. And the deeper you go, the more commitments you make and so on, the more your prestige is committed, the harder it is to pull back. You can't pull back. With the result that Hitler is faced with this choice. Either to abandon his demands, in which case his prestige, he feels, will be broken at home, or to actually go ahead with the war. He tries very hard to avoid a war with Britain, going to the lengths of making this non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union, giving the Soviets a greater share of Poland from that pact than Germany would get even from a successful war against Poland. This is, you know, the declaration of war comes. German forces move into Poland at the beginning of September 1939. The British respond basically with an ultimatum and a declaration of war. And he receives the declaration of war. He turns to the foreign minister, Ribbentrop, at that point. He says, what do we do now? Was nun, Germany? This was not a war, the war with Britain and France in 1939 that Hitler wanted. He intended war at a later point, but this war came too early for him. Now, what this means is that if even the war of 1939 is not to be understood as a war of German aggression, pure and simple, well, that has implications in terms of our general understanding of what makes a war. If even the most aggressive political leader in modern history, Adolf Hitler, you know, got into a war that he did not intend, well, that makes you think twice about the whole aggressor model, the aggressive theory of what makes war. Okay? So that's an important point. Okay, again, next time, bring the Taylor book, and we'll get into these issues in a different way, but through a historiographical analysis.